wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this March 29th Monday. This morning on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick talks to Alexander Reed Ross on how the radical right has grown over the recent past and what can be done to re-marginalize them. Ross is the author of the book Against the Fascist Creep. Book Mole Larry Bolden honors the social commentary and storytelling of Walter Mosley. Originally written for Black History Month and read by Patricia Kohlberg, Larry Bolden discusses how Mosley shows clearly how a novelist can be more honest and direct in exposing racism, providing scathing social commentary, than can a journalist. President Biden faces intensified criticisms on his new administration's handling of migration at the southern border and whether the recent influx of migrants poses a true crisis. Regular contributor on The Old Mole, Sophie Smith, talks with Jan Hawken about the politics of migration and what her co-authored report describes as, quote, a search and rescue crisis in the borderlands. Smith is a teacher, writer, and humanitarian aid worker residing in Aravaca, Arizona. And we conclude today's program with a segment from the archive. The rich claim their private wealth is under assault in proposals to increase taxes on the wealthy to pay for more improved health care. But do they really own their wealth? Clayton Mortgage explains why they don't and how taxes and justice are related. Clayton Mortgage was a longtime member of the Old Mole and passed away in January 2020. This segment originally aired in July 2009. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting community radio and programs like the Old Mole. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, KBOO/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Bill Resnick and Alexander Reed Ross.
Hello, Alexander Reed Ross. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you very much.
Alexander Reed Ross teaches at Portland State. He's studied and written on the rise of the radical, or call them neo-fascist right, the alt-right in this country and internationally. We'll be discussing how to stop and re-marginalize the right that has grown from the margins to a very strong position in the Republican Party in recent years. Alexander Ross's best-known work is the book Against the Fascist Creep. That was published in 2017 by 221. It's no longer a creep. It's moving forward quite relentlessly, greatly aided by Trump, and that's especially concerning to those who know how the Nazis took power in Germany. Today, Alex Ross will discuss how they can be stopped and marginalized, what's been done here and abroad, and why it succeeded or failed. Alex, give us your views of how they have so spectacularly grown over the last 60 years, and especially recently.
Well, there's been a lot of different kinds of tendencies that have risen up through different avenues, mostly through linking themselves to powerful figures and developing institutions that provide bridges between very radical and extremely violent subcultures on the one hand, and then the mainstream political and cultural discourse on the other. And then you have subcultural movements, fascist-aligned punk bands, Nazi skinhead bands, different kinds of cultural fashions and modes that arise and try to hitch onto mainstream currents and tendencies. And so they'll sort of glean followers like that. So a lot of the rise of fascism simply takes place in a kind of wolf in sheep's clothing type of way, trying to masquerade as more mainstream and draw people into the movement through various sort of initiations. And this is what the alt-right would call hiding your power level. So the idea is that you don't want to show everybody that you fully believe in the fascist idea. You want to gradually draw them into the idea by formulating all of the predicates in as clear a fashion as possible and convincing a fashion as possible without identifying them immediately with fascism. So eventually they simply wake up and realize that they're white nationalists rather than bringing them white nationalism an obvious package.
I guess in the current period, one could look at the demonization of immigrants. In fact, here and around the world, that's one of their major discourses that can lead to a kind of white nationalist, neo-fascist affiliations by people. Though, of course, they've been so successful, I think, and been written about, you've talked about it, how the great pressure and troubles of downwardly mobile Americans, many of them white, exurban, and rural people, also people in the cities with precarious work and not seeing a future for themselves or their kids, with the internet sounding those alarms and the conspiracy theories, they're very easily attracted to this right-wing discourse. Instead of seeing their problems that were of a recomposing economy that's deeply disadvantaging them and dominated all the decisions, the rules of the game have been changed in the favor of the elite and wealthy because corporations sort of dominate politics now in a lot of ways that we can't go into. Tell us about how they appeal to too many working people.
I think that there's two lines here. On the one hand, you're absolutely right about the declining cultural hegemony of white adult males in the United States. This is especially felt in the suburbs. You have men who are pretty gainfully employed. They own stores or they work in construction, building trades, or what have you. And they see themselves as being less and less represented in the mainstream. And I'm talking about straight white males mostly. So they see commercials with representation of people who they don't identify with and that they have been rather prejudiced against. And it infuriates them and they want to reclaim a kind of a cultural capital, right? The wages of whiteness, as it were. And on the other hand, you have people with a lot of time on their hands. You know, if you look at Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and people like that, a lot of them have fairly successful businesses and operations and time surfing the internet to make connections with other people who are like them and spread conspiracy theories, listen to podcasts with Alex Jones and Steve Bannon and all that kind of stuff. And I think it really is this right-wing media echo chamber that infuriates people and gets them to hate their neighbors. But on the other side of things, of course, there are people who are alienated within the system of capital and they're looking for alternatives. And this is where you tend to find the allure of a populist discourse. It doesn't matter if you're left or right, as long as you hate the establishment. And through these kinds of matrices, you do get people developing national socialist ideologies with the aid and support of the Republican Party, which has a radical faction that identifies it as a nationalist workers' party. So that's really where we start to see a kind of an amalgam taking place, an ideological national socialist position in the United States, which is quite dangerous.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, talking to Alexander Reed Ross, who wrote the book Against the Fascist Creep. We've been discussing how neo-fascism, not long ago on the margin of U.S. society and politics, has now grown to be a major force within the Republican Party, and they could well take power in upcoming years if the situation of working people and the alienated and marginalized people who think that their white culture in the golden days of white supremacy, that they've been left behind and are no longer at the center of the story, And, of course, that the situation of working people doesn't markedly improve. And that leads to the question of what might be done to drive the fascists back into the margins. What do you see as the key tasks of the left?
Well, I think fundamentally opposing fascism by all available means. You know, I think that counter-protesting fascist mobilizations is important. I also think that it's important to have no truck with fascists culturally, and to create a counterculture that excludes racism, sexism, and all forms of oppression. So I think that opposition to fascism is the main current. So it's important to keep that going and to, you know, create thriving spaces of discourse, dialogue, conversation, debate, active engagement in politics against fascism, not in contradistinction, but against. And one good way of responding to fascism is simply by taking up the progressive movement, by pushing the cause of unions, healthcare for everyone, and really making the U.S. and the rest of the world a safer and better place for everyone, so that fascists aren't able to draw in disaffected people who, like you say, feel alienated and left alone in the world. That's important stuff for policy. I think the first resurgence of fascism in 2015 was very much fueled by the rage against the systems that caused the financial crash and the fact that nobody was held accountable and the ensuing situation where the rich were getting richer and the poor were getting poorer. So the accumulation of capital was part and parcel to the reaction from the far right. And by opposing both the far right reaction and the systems that fuel it, I think that we can create a pragmatic and reasonable alternative with many different actors.
Yeah, one barrier, it seems a very important barrier to improving the prospects of all working people and making this a much more functional society in a lot of ways, is dealing with the climate crisis. The Green New Deal, of course, does try and deal with all of those crises, and it's worth fighting for, especially because many of the directions it takes really lead to a far more democratic society and democratic models that will be necessary in the new future. One great barrier to it is that the neo-fascist front recognizes that they have to create chaos and dysfunction and hamstring efforts at reform and non-reformist reform in order to delegitimate the government they want to replace. Even through electoral means, they almost did it this last year. And if things continue to unravel in this country, which is quite possible, they could take power if the military and police really cooperate with them. That's really a problem. That's a terrible scenario. How do we deal, though, with their efforts to create chaos on the streets and political discussion and overall social policy?
Right. I think the primary motivator there is disinformation. You know, you have this street-level violence, of course, then you have a lot of problems with systemic racism within the police or within the economy. And one of the things that contributes to the violence is a toxic information system where you have stuff like, if you remember last year, the Antifa buses coming into your town, right? You have all of that stuff. You've got disinformation about the surge at the border is something that is unprecedented, all that kind of stuff. You know, it's actually complete lies, right? The current situation at the border is not particularly different from any year. During this time of year, you get a increase number of people coming across the border because the weather is better at this point. So, you know, all of the hysteria about it is just to get people riled up. So the more we can combat that process whereby lies fuel hatred and anger, which fuels violence, the better off we'll be. And I think that just requires people constructing a tolerant public sphere where people can, you know, exchange ideas and thoughts disagree with one another, have different opinions, and still be friends. But that process requires the exclusion of fascism, because fascists are motivated by disinformation. So, you know, we really have to get at scientific consensus-based reality here. And, I mean, not everybody has to be a scientist, right? You don't have to get everything right. You don't have to have so-called right opinions about every single thing, right? But we do need to realize that you can't just make stuff up. I think that is one of the biggest things. And if you look at climate change, I mean, here's a perfect example. Everybody can talk about what we need to do about climate change. We can have different opinions. We can think different things. There are all kinds of legitimate positions to make here. But we all have to get off on the same foot that climate change is real and it's happening. But, you know, the far right doesn't want to do that. They want to actually say, no, it's not happening. And beyond that, they want to influence everybody else to say, well, maybe climate change isn't a real thing.
That might be their downfall, it seems to me, because when New Orleans and Miami disappear, that'll be a while, but some great storm could do it, or Long Island or many other coastal areas. It becomes clear when the storms are so immense, far greater than ever before, when people are dying, when their flora, fauna, and birds are no longer what they used to be, and food prices start spiking because of that. People are going to wake up, I think, and realize that the far right and the fossil fuel industry has done them a great disservice and shouldn't be listened to. That could be the end for them. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Alexander and Ross, who wrote the book Against Fascist Creep. Let's discuss one final issue. In some ways, it's distracted from many of the issues you brought up of changing consciousness and building forces. The issue is how we deal with the marches and gatherings and demonstrations, the recruitment efforts in colleges and high schools even, and of course the internet. What do we do about the marches and demonstrations? How do we deal with them?
Well, like I said, a clear opposition is necessary. In some cases, it's extremely unsafe, and usually organizers responsible for opposition efforts have a pretty good understanding of when to not show up. And there are definitely times. At the same time, I don't think you can really just will away extremely violent fascists who are trying to march through the streets. I mean, these guys will absolutely beat and even kill innocent people who are not the right skin color, who don't fit their ideological point of view. So what do you do with this extremely volatile element that just wants to ride around and terrorize people? That's something that society in general should not accept and should reject, however that job can get done within, like, the constraints. Obviously, there are always limits, but, you know, we always need to value the safety of society over people's pretend right to violate it. The Bill of Rights does not have an amendment that says you have the right to freedom of speech, you have the right to terrorize people. Like, terrorizing people is not part of your constitutional rights.
Yeah, my concern often is that the fascists do their marches in order to provoke any kind of violence against them, and they get the police on their side protecting them, and of course the police will go at the left regardless of what happens, and they have agents provocateur in our ranks that look just like us. And it becomes not just an effort to stop the fascists, but when the police are there, they, in fact, get involved. A lot of the times they do. And then it becomes police versus us, with the fascists sitting back. That's a terrible dynamic. We have to be really careful about how we deal with the police and not antagonize, although they're antagonistic themselves. But reinforcing that could lead to a police affiliation with the right, which, of course, they're trying to do. They've infiltrated the police and the army. That's another major issue that we have to deal with.
You're right, and I've witnessed a lot of those observations personally. At the same time, we've also had incidents where extremely violent fascist groups show up. They're met by an anti-fascist side. The two sides fight. There's a lot of violence, and the fascist group ends up leaving. And according to their personal messages to one another, they left early. This happened last year. A group came to town, was looking for people to attack, actually was met with a counter-protest, and violence ensued. Their plan had been to stay until the evening and to ambush people and attack them in the evening as well as during the day. And they left early, according to their personal messages, because they had effectively been fought back during the day. And, you know, I don't like to think about human society degenerating to this point, but it does appear to me, given the messages that I've read, that these people wanted to show up during the daytime to simply beat up anyone who opposed them, and then to run the streets at night, beating up anybody who they didn't like. And they were prevented from doing the second part because the first part didn't go as well as they had hoped. So yeah. It is a complicated situation, and I agree with you about people need to be careful, and this is not an ideal thing, right? The ideal thing is prevention of fascist mobilizations, not getting drawn out into the broad daylight with a bunch of fascists who have guns and knives, you know, that's and shields. You know, what we don't want is full-scale street war with American fascism. I mean, that is hardly an opportune goal. But, you know, once it's gotten to that level, obviously the simpler preventative tactics have failed. So that in and of itself is already a failure. And I think if you wanted to ask me, like, ideally, what do we do here? You know, I would say ideally we create a culture that prevents fascist organizing from even starting off.
Right.
And to do we have to be really firm about our commitments to the exclusion of violent and dangerous fascists.
I want to end this with a quote from you and Shane Burley, also in Portlander. It appeared in Truth Out. I read it recently. If activists want to reduce the potential for violence and deter further far-right demonstrations, it will require connecting as a true community, both in response to threats from the radical right and back in the neighborhoods, workplaces, and community centers they share. It seems to me that a large turnout of ordinary citizens who jeer at the fascists, who make life uncomfortable for them, it seems to me that we really have to ultimately build a strong, as you pointed out, anti-fascist culture of people who are ready to oppose them, whatever their efforts to organize. Alexander Reed Ross, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thanks for having me, Bill. It's been a pleasure.
Next on The Old Mole, Larry Bolden honors the social commentary and storytelling of Walter Mosley. This review was originally written for Black History Month and is read by Patricia Kohlberg.
Good morning. This is Patricia Kohlberg, and today I'm going to read a review of one of my favorite authors by one of my favorite book reviewers, the Mole's own book mole, Larry Bolden. E.Z. Rollins is as tough and hard-boiled as any detective in the mystery genre. He's been asked by a Vietnam vet to look into a possible murder in a Southern California orange grove. Quote, "I would have turned him down out of hand if it weren't for my understanding of the America I both love and loathe. In America, everything is about either race or money or some combination of the two. Who you are, what you have, what you look like, where your people came from, and what God looked over their breed, these were the most important questions. Added into that is the race of men and the race of women. The rich, famous, and powerful believe they have a race, and the poor know for a fact that they do. The thing about it is that most people have more than one race. White people have Italian, Germans, Irish, Poles, English, Scots, Portuguese, Russian, Old World, Spaniard, New World, rich, and many combinations thereof. Black people have a color scheme from high yellow to moonless night, from Octoroon to deepest Congo. And New World Spanish have every nation from Mexico to Puerto Rico, from Colombia to Venezuela, each of which is a race of its own. Not to mention the empires from Aztec to Mayan to Olmec. I'm a black man closer to Mississippi midnight than its yellow moon. Also, I'm a Westerner, a Californian formerly from the South, Louisiana and Texas, to be exact. I'm a father, a reader, a private detective, and a veteran. End quote. In his most recent novel, Blood Grove, Walter Mosley lets Easy describe the America of the 1960s in which a black detective is a rarity. In lieu of payment from a client, Easy is given a year-long lease of a pale yellow 1968 Rolls-Royce Phantom 6, which will become his at the end of that year unless he is paid $60,000. Since he has a written contract showing he has the right to drive such a fine car, he decides to drive into Beverly Hills. Quote, I had even made it a block or two past that when the flashing red lights appeared in the extra-wide rearview mirror. It was one of those wake-up calls that happen in the lives of black men and women in America when they mistakenly believe they have crossed over to freedom. I pulled to the curb, put both hands on the steering wheel, and sat patiently awaiting the rendering of the calculation of my situation. That equation was a matter of simple addition. Rolls-Royce plus black man without driver's cap plus any day of the century equals stop and frisk, question and dominate, and like the solution of pi, that process had the potential of going on forever. The whole process took about half an hour. If I added up all the half hours the police, security forces, MPs, bureaucrats, bank tellers, and even gas station attendants had stolen from my life, I could make me a 12-year-old boy versed in useless questions, meaningless insults, and spite as thick as black tar. End quote. Although the story told in Blood Grove is a detailed and interesting one, what I find much more interesting is the social commentary Mosley provides along the way. Easy quickly garages the Rolls and borrows a plain blue car, knowing that he will be unable to drive the Rolls to do his business without daily repeats of being pulled over and questioned, or worse. In this, his newest novel, Mosley adds an ingredient he had touched on in an earlier novel, Little Green, his fascination with countercultural youth. Quote, driving west down the strip was slow going, but I liked the streets filled with hippies, head shops, and discos. There was what they were calling a cultural revolution going on among the youth of America. They wanted to drop out and end the war, make love for its own sake, and forget the prejudices of the past. These long-haired, dope-smoking, often unemployed wanderers gave me insight into what my country, might be. End quote. There is the usual cast of characters in this novel. Easy's adopted children, Jesus and Feather, the dangerous best friend Raymond, called Mouse, who is usually called in to do the dirty work for Easy, and a couple of good cops who help Easy obtain information and get him out of scrapes with the law. After many harrowing adventures, Easy helps the Vietnam vet and solves the mystery, giving the reader his summation of Easy's reflections on the state of the world. Quote, 1969 was an interesting year. There was strong anti-war action from the colleges and universities and all kinds of black political insurgents. The sleeping giant of white guilt was awakening, and there seemed to be some hope for the future. If you were innocent enough or ignorant enough, you might have believed that things were improving in such a way that all Americans could expect a fair shake. But of my many flaws, neither innocence nor ignorance played a part. End quote. It seems to me that it is easier to describe and call out racial injustice as a writer of a fiction than as a social scientist or reporter. Walter Mosley describes things as he sees them, and he does so with the direct experience of what it is like to be black and poor in America. He also understands how racism and sexism are connected, and he blows the whistle loudly and clearly. If you, like many readers I know, have read Devil in a Blue Dress, but not others of Mosley's many novels, I recommend them all to you as wonderfully told stories and stark pieces of social commentary. I have been talking about Walter Mosley's 2021 novel, Blood Grove. This is Patricia Kullberg reading today for Larry Bolden and for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio, and this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host this morning, Denise Morris. In our second half of our program, we'll hear Sophie Smith talk with Jan Hawken about the politics of migration and her co-authored report describing a search and rescue crisis in the borderlands. Jan?
Welcome to KBOO, Sophie Smith.
Thanks so much for having me, Jan.
We'll be talking today about a recently published report that you co-authored on missing migrants in the Southwest borderlands. But before we take up the findings in that report, let's talk about your assessment of what's happening now at the border. You've been a humanitarian aid worker in Arizona through a number of administrations now, from the Obama years through Trump and now the new Biden administration. How would you characterize the situation this past month? And is there a crisis? And if so, for whom?
Yeah, I think that what's called the crisis at the southern border, unfortunately, is nothing new, although new populations are being brought into what is really a deadly system on the border in terms of how the flow of people, the movement of people migrating is being controlled by U.S. policies. So we're definitely seeing more and more people fleeing from especially the Northern Triangle as a consequence of extractive neoliberal policies that have been advanced by people like Joe Biden in the past. What I think is really not being covered in terms of the crisis on the southern border is the way in which people closing the southern border, as we saw Mayorkas do this week, means closing conventional border crossings, so ports of entry, and not allowing asylum seekers to present themselves, which doesn't simply shut down the border, but actually causes many people to then attempt irregular border crossings between ports of entry through extremely remote desert areas along the southwest border, like where I live here in Aravaca, Arizona, which has over the years, since 1994, since the walls were first put up in border cities, and really we started to see a buildup of militarized style enforcement in and around ports of entry, has led to the recorded deaths of at least 8,000 people, although that number is believed to be likely about 10 times higher, because many people who perish attempting this deadly crossing through remote areas rather than presenting through ports of entry perish in areas where their remains are never recovered or never identified. So what has been ongoing since about 1994 is not only a crisis of unaccompanied children and sort of the headlines that we're seeing now, but a crisis of both death and really of disappearance as a consequence of U.S. policy for the approach to controlling the migration from south to north in the region.
Well, let's continue with more of the findings in this report, titled Left to Die, Report on Missing Migrants and Borderlands. It was published by the humanitarian aid organizations No More Deaths and La Colación de Derechos Humanos. And as a co-author of that report, you worked with a number of aid organizations that are involved in search and rescue operations in that region. And what about this aspect of the tragedy of lives lost on the border? There's been much over the last few years about kids in cages, children torn from the arms of their mothers, but less on this suffering and death kind of on the periphery of what's galvanized some of the moral outrage about migrants at the borders. Say a bit more about the missing migrants, because it's a different picture and more peripheral to the suffering that people are more familiar with.
So whereas we might see more and more kind of media exposure of what's happening in and around ports of entry in terms of encampments, caravans, people being arrested and held in detention. Like I mentioned, the hardening of controls at those ports of entry have led so many people to attempt to cross the border through the deserts in areas that are really unseen and unexposed to media coverage. And so this report really focused in on those areas, on what happens in this crisis in which, as you can imagine, as more and more people attempt to cross through the desert to enter the U.S., this has caused not only a crisis of death and disappearance, but a search and rescue crisis, as many people on a daily basis come into distress. They run out of food or water to survive, become injured. Lower extremity injuries are extremely deadly in remote areas, and separated from their traveling companions as a consequence of aggressive border patrol tactics in the backcountry, like the use of helicopters to swoop down and scatter groups that are traveling together, separating people from their companions who then become lost to the wilderness. So as a consequence of this, for those who do have access to a cell phone and are able to place a call, there are many, many calls of distress ringing out every day to both family members in the United States and to 911 call centers here in Pima County, which has seen about 50% of the recorded deaths of people crossing the border. There's an average of 4.5 stress calls from those crossing the border, calling for rescue, calling for emergency services on a daily basis. This report scrutinizes what is the role of government agencies in terms of responding to this crisis of search and rescue. Are government agencies mobilizing in response to the distress calls of the undocumented on U.S. soil? And what we find by looking at the records kept by a community-based hotline run by Derechos Humanos, which is a migrant justice organization, what we find by scrutinizing the records of 500 emergency cases that came into their hotline in which they were advocating for a government response is that there's really a segregated emergency response system in the borderlands, one in which all 911 call centers, all law enforcement agencies, all consulates are forwarding emergency calls from those perceived to be undocumented and crossing the border away from conventional emergency services that would mobilize in response to you or I if we came into distress hiking in the same exact geographies in southern Arizona. And they funnel these calls to the U.S. Border Patrol to be handled. Now, the U.S. Border Patrol spends 99% of its budget annually on enforcement activities. It is not, by any definition, a robust search and rescue outfit, and yet all of these calls are being funneled to Border Patrol. And what we find is that when it comes to the outcomes of these cases, that Border Patrol 40% of the time outright refuses to respond to emergency calls from those in distress, refuses to mobilize their resources, maintains an enforcement priority in terms of their activities on the border and refuses outright to take any action whatsoever, and that over 25 of these cases end in the death or disappearance of the person. And this is just radically diminished in terms of the provision of life-saving services when compared to the search and rescue outfits that will mobilize for someone like you or I, or tourists who are hiking in the same area, which have a 99% success rate in locating the missing person, whether they locate them alive or deceased. But we see that disappearance is a really normalized outcome with these calls that get forwarded to Border Patrol.
One of your findings that you've documented in previous reports describes how this very crisis of migrants in remote areas struggling to find a place where they can live and breathe is actually created this crisis. And as Border Patrol push people to more and more hostile and dangerous terrain. So it's not simply that people wandered off a trail and recklessly pursued a path through dangerous terrain. Could you say a little bit about why so many people are in these difficult situations crossing the border? Because I think most of what gets covered are points of entry or the areas along the border where, you know, the Trump wall has been constructed. And the irrationality of that, I think, is apparent to many, if not most, but not these other aspects of more remote terrain.
So you're absolutely right, Jan, that this scenario in which people are crossing through remote areas is highly engineered and is a product of an explicit policy that was adopted by the U.S. Border Patrol in 1994, called Prevention Through Deterrence. And it was designed in partnership with the Department of Defense strategists who were practiced in regime change, carrying out regime change in Latin America, low intensity conflict doctrine. And the idea was that the border could not be fully sealed. The southern border could not be fully sealed, but it could be controlled by making undocumented border crossing as dangerous and deadly as possible, with the intention to have a deterrent effect that it would prevent others from attempting the journey once enough people had suffered and died attempting the crossing. And so for this reason, we start to see after 1994, walls go up in and around urban areas, surveillance technology, concentration of agents in and around these urban areas with the explicit intention to deflect undocumented migration out into the open of the desert where people can find themselves in what they term in their policy documents, mortal danger. So this is absolutely the intended effect of the kind of design of enforcement activities out here. And then we also document in our earlier reports in the series, the kind of daily tactics used by Border Patrol, like the use of helicopters that I mentioned, that force people into situations in which they lose their supplies, lose their companions, and are very likely to not survive. And so we see this scenario. And in our report, we compared the numbers of cases within these nearly 500 emergency cases handled by this community hotline, the number of cases in which the distressed person reported having been scattered by a Border Patrol helicopter or ground patrol as a cause of them coming into distress, versus the number of cases in which there was a record of a Border Patrol mobilization to save that distressed person's life. And we found that Border Patrol agents are twice as likely to take part in causing someone to come into distress than they are in participating in their rescue. So no matter how much funding goes towards Border Patrol so-called search and rescue, we know that they will only be responding to a crisis of their own making. So our conclusion is that Border Patrol should have no business in the provision of emergency services, that they're a militarized law enforcement agency, and that the root causes of what are putting people in the desert to begin with need to be addressed, that we need to see the demilitarization of the border, particularly in and around ports of entry, the decriminalization of border crossings, a pathway for people to be able to safely present themselves at the border rather than attempting these really harrowing journeys.
People often don't realize how historically recent the hardening of the border between the U.S. and Mexico is, that for even earlier in my adult life, you could cross quite easily between U.S. and Mexico, and this hardening and militarizing of the border has become a politically constructed boundary that you're saying both the Democrats and the right wing have mobilized around as an illusory form of protection of U.S. citizens. And thinking now with the Biden administration and Democratic Party policies, what do you see as the new discourse around the border as Biden has emphasized a humanitarian approach addressing the root causes? And Kamala Harris has also pledged that kind of a more humanitarian touch.
Yeah, I think what we can expect is something similar to what we saw under the Obama administration, which was quite a bit of rhetoric and some important policies that served a minority population of undocumented people already within the U.S. to provide some pathways to relative status and stability, but with the trade-off being ballooning funding for what they call border security, which is actually border militarization and the heightening of these kinds of tactics that put people in mortal danger. So we see this kind of bundling.
Different kinds of walls.
Yes. We see the kind of promotion of smart border technology in the place of border walls and the pairing of a pathway to citizenship in their language with increased border security spending. And I think it's really important that our movements not repeat this kind of political compensation if we're really here to support the dignity and survival of all people, regardless of status. We need to both promote decriminalization and demilitarization and not accept these huge contracts going out to border security outfits to further militarize the southern border as a trade-off for kind of marginal pathways to citizenship.
Well, thank you, Sophie Smith, so much for your report today, and we look forward to your quarterly reports. We'll link the interview with you today to the report, Left to Die, Report on Missing Migrants in Borderlands. Thanks so much for being with us today, Sophie Smith.
Thank you so much, Jan.
Every morning, just about this time, I get the feeling I'm lost. And beating at my brain, and I'm getting a feeling I'm lost. Take me right, baby mine. Take me right, baby mine. Lonely heart at night, but in the morning light, that's gone, and your love is like a knife. In the darkness, you are kind, touch and gentle all the time. That's gone, and your love is like a knife. Treat me right.
We conclude our program with a segment from the archives, which originally aired in July 2009. I think you'll find a lot that still resonates in this short piece by Clayton Morgridge on wealth and taxation.
Two publications that represent our ruling elite are The Wall Street Journal and The Economist. They are both outraged by the Congressional Democrats' health care plan for, among other things, the tax burden it would impose on their constituency. The Democrats want to ram through one of the greatest raids on private income and business in American history, screams an editorial in The Wall Street Journal. The Economist grumbles that the House bill hopes to achieve near universal health coverage by soaking the rich. So this seems like a good moment for us to be thinking about taxes. Soaking the rich is something the rich, with a few notable exceptions, see as a bad thing. But should the rest of us see it as a good thing? Should we join up with Robin Hood to steal from the rich and give to the poor? But whether we think soaking the rich is good or bad, either way, we buy into the illusion that the rich actually own their wealth. In their book, The Myth of Ownership, Taxes and Justice, Liam Murphy and Thomas Nagel try to expose this illusion. The most extreme objection to taxation is the idea that taxation is theft. Here is Murray N. Rothbard writing back in 1969. The first great lesson to learn about taxation is that taxation is simply robbery. No more and no less. For what is robbery? Robbery is the taking of a man's property by the use of violence or the threat thereof, and therefore without the victim's consent. And what else is taxation? A more moderate but just as cynical view of taxation is the common saying that nothing is inevitable but death and taxes. Taxes, in other words, are a necessary evil. But what makes people resent paying taxes, even when they would agree that they could not live without the benefits of government? According to Murphy and Nagel, it's because we suffer from an illusion that is inevitable in our economic system, the illusion that our gross income, what appears at the top of our pay stubs or on the deposits that go into our bank accounts from investments, is our own private property, and that the taxes we must pay are taking away from us something that is rightfully ours. We may agree that it has to happen, but we nevertheless feel that we have paid out something that was, if only fleetingly, our own. Well, you might ask, well, why shouldn't I think of it that way? I earn X amount of dollars, that's my salary, and some of that is taken away from me and sent off to Salem and Washington, D.C., leaving me with less than I had. But look again at what you call your pre-tax earnings. Your gross salary is already the result of a lot of bookkeeping, of the vast accounting system that goes with our economy. Any economy is a vast system for distributing wealth between capital and labor, for starters, but also among different kinds of workers and among the owners and producers of millions of kinds of services and resources. So your share of the wealth is already the result of a complex system of allocation. And in fact, what government does is always already a part of that. Whatever you and your employer produce only happens within a system that is regulated and facilitated by governments at all levels, from police protection to highways to the money system. So there is no way to separate out what you have coming to you independently of what must be provided for government. Here's how Murphy and Nagel put it. Individual citizens don't own anything except through laws that are enacted and enforced by the state. Therefore, the issues of taxation are not about how the state should appropriate and distribute what its citizens already own, but about how it should allow ownership to be determined. Thus, they go on, we have to think of property as what is created by the tax system, rather than what is disturbed or encroached on by the tax system. Property rights are the rights people have in the resources they are entitled to control after taxes, not before. If our society decides that justice demands that everyone have access to good health care, and that this requires that more of the nation's wealth should be funneled through a government agency running a public insurance plan, then that reallocation of wealth is not a raid on private income and business. Taxation is not theft. It is an adjustment in the economic system, the system that distributes all the wealth our society produces. But even if we get over the illusion that people's gross income truly belongs to them, we may not get over the resentment. And that is because the determination of who gets what is not democratic or transparent. Congress is not going to give us the health care reform that over 70% of us want, namely Medicare for all, because Congress represents the wealthy insurance companies and for-profit health care industry more than they do the voters. This is why our taxes feel like they are being extorted from us by a foreign occupying power. Our voice is not heard. Our interests are ignored. A great example of this was The Economist claiming that the minimal health care reform proposed by the Democrats is, quote, very far to the left of American political discourse, unquote, which only goes to prove how narrow is the band of voices the mainstream press can hear or acknowledge. In an interview with Bill Resnick here on The Old Mole a couple of weeks ago, Robin Hanel said this about raising taxes on the rich.
I think that many liberals have basically conceded too much philosophical ground when we talk about taxes. The truth of the matter is that's wealth that the rest of us created, and all we're doing is taking it and using it in the way that it needs to be used instead of letting it be frittered away by the people that have it. Another way to put it is this. The income and wealth that the very, very wealthy have, a much higher percentage of that is not earned or deserved than the income and wealth of those of us who have less. So all we are doing with progressive taxation and with progressive taxes on wealth is we are partially rectifying sort of an injustice that's out there at work in the economic system on a daily basis. And it's only a partial rectification of the injustice, and we should always understand that.
In other words, the whole economic system gives the rich more than their due, and a progressive tax system is at least a first and partial step towards adjusting that inequity.
I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Community Radio, and a big thank you to KBOO staff who have kept our non-commercial community radio on the air 24/7 over this last challenging year. It takes a labor. The Old Mole comes to you every Monday morning at 9 a.m. Thanks to our contributors and guests for making today's show possible, Bill Resnick and Alexander Reed Ross, Larry Bolden and Patricia Kohlberg, Jan Hawken and Sophie Smith, and, of course, the late Clayton Morgridge. Patricia Kohlberg and John Nelson edited portions of today's program. You can hear The Old Mole on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, or download the Old Mole podcast and listen on the go. I'm Denise Morris, and I've been your host this morning. Tune in next week for more news, views, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist perspective.